Hey everyone, it's time for another reaction video. Today we're going to do something a little bit different. You all know that typically when I do reaction videos, I'm reacting to science deniers or idiots of some variety, be they flat earthers or creationists or anti-vaxxers or quantum mysticism woo peddlers or things of that nature. So I'm always reacting to content that sucks. But then I thought, wouldn't it be neat if I reacted to something that's good instead? And I could kind of chime in and add my two cents about whatever science is being discussed. So I started to think about what's something that I'm aware of that would be a suitable candidate for this. And then I remembered a video by Bill Wirtz. So Bill Wirtz, if you don't know, I'm actually not sure how much content he's still making. I just remembered this video from a while ago, and the video is called History of the Entire World, I guess. Very unassuming, all lowercase, much like the channel name Bill Wirtz. And it's an extremely popular video. So many of you will have seen this video, or whether you know it by heart or you will remember it once we start, but it was released 9 years ago. It's got 183 million views. That's bananas. That's a lot of views. So this is, I think that, again, I'm not sure how many of you will know this. I bet a lot of you will, but I'm sure that some of you are not familiar with this video. And it really is fantastic. So what it is it's just what it sounds like, or actually it's more than that. It's not just the history of the world. It's the history of the whole universe. So it really is going through in just under 20 minutes, it's going through cosmology and planetary science and then geology and early molecular biology and evolutionary biology, getting through anthropology and archaeology, and then early societies, and then through world history, human world history, all the way up to present day. And so there's a couple of things that are really great about this video. Number one, it's hilarious. Bill is extremely funny, and this video is extremely funny, but it's more than that. It's actually just, it's really well done. It's really well written. Everything, the science and the history are very accurate. There's very little in it that would be considered inaccurate in any significant way, which is an accomplishment. But third, I should say, it's actually, it's really impressive. Like, it's difficult to condense information and explain something accurately and succinctly, and this video achieves that. There are certain parts where it makes you laugh, not just because it's funny, but it's also kind of like, wow, I can't believe that you found that wording to just kind of summarize either this aspect of science or this period of world history in a sentence, but you did, and it works. So it's a great video. Unlike all of my other content, where it's like, do not bother watching this content. You're only here for my commentary. Some of you even skip the parts where the other people are talking. This is the opposite. If you haven't seen this, you're gonna want to watch this video without me interrupting it. So you can either do it first, or better yet, don't disrupt the flow for the algorithm and watch it after the fact. I think after you get me explaining some of the additional tidbits or contextualizing at least some of the scientific information, it'll be a really enjoyable view. But if you really want to see it before me doing all the interrupting, you can totally pause and watch this video. It's well worth the watch. But I'm going to jump in here. I figured this would be something where I could add a little bit of extra information, especially for all of the science bits, the cosmology, the planetary science, the biochemistry and biology, anthropology, getting into some of the world history. I definitely can add some context and clarifying statements. Once it gets really deep into the weeds on world history, I'll have less to say. I am working on world history content, but I'm only through the middle of the, I'm doing Middle Ages content right now. So once you get past that, I have less to say. Early civilizations, I have maybe a few tidbits, but yeah, so don't get upset. I'm going to be, this is a video that's so good that I hope you won't be upset when I interrupt it, as opposed to stuff where I'm debunking creationists, where I am a breath of fresh air from the garbage that they're spewing. This is a great video, but At any rate, I think that this is going to be fun. This is going to be a little bit of a change of pace. You can learn something from the video. You can learn something from me. All of it will be a wonderful, fine and dandy educational experience. So whether you've seen it or not, here we go. This is Bill Wirtz's History of the Entire World, I guess. And let's get started right now. Before we dive into the world of Wirtz, I wanted to tell you about this really cool book from Hungry Minds. It's called The Book, The Ultimate Guide to Rebuilding Civilization. We're about to whiz through a bunch of information on science and history rapid fire, and that's kind of what this book is too. Check this out. It's a visual journey through human history, 400 pages, 180 topics, all with this incredible medieval art style, making tools, farming, machinery, all kinds of rare knowledge. It has everything you need to build your own civilization from scratch. Whether you're into engineering or the arts, this will captivate you. I want to show you a few pages myself. Here's a section on how to build different types of shelters. Could come in handy in the upcoming apocalypse. There's even a section that teaches you how to make your own penicillin. Talk about do it yourself. This is a super cool book. It's the perfect coffee table book. You can pick it up, learn about something for 10 minutes, then put it back down for later, and it's the perfect gift for that nerd in your life. Click the link in the description or use the QR code you see here. Make sure to use the promo code ProfessorDave10 and pick up your copy from Hungry Minds today.
Hi, you're on a rock, floating in space. Pretty cool, huh? Some of it's water. Fuck it. Actually, most of it's water. I can't even get from here to there without buying a boat.
So that's like one of very few technical inaccuracies, right? The most of the world is not water. Most of the world is, you've got an iron and nickel core and then a lot of rock, silicates and stuff. Most of the surface of the earth is water. That's true. About 70-something percent. But no, most of the earth is not water. It's rock. But we'll forgive that.
It's sad. I'm sad. I miss you. How did this happen? A long time ago, actually never, and also now, nothing is nowhere. When? Never. Makes sense, right? Like I said, it didn't happen. Nothing was never anywhere. That's why it's been everywhere.
So this is very interesting. Nothing was never. So when you want to, and I had to do this, he's setting up to talk about the beginning. T equals zero, Big Bang cosmology. How did it all start? And I had to deal with this in my astronomy series. I start out after Introduction to Astronomy. I start with cosmology because I wanted to do everything chronological. And I wanted to start with T equals zero, Big Bang. And I had to do a little bit, and it was kind of like this. I think I might have been influenced by this video because I saw this a couple of times a long time ago, probably around when I was making that content in like 2017 or something. I haven't seen this video since then, or at least not in a very, very long time. But it's very difficult to talk about the T equals zero, that it was the genesis of space and time, or, you know, space-time. So having to talk about what was before the beginning of the universe kind of doesn't make sense. Space and time being created from the initial singularity, there is no space there before the initial singularity. There's no time before it. So how do you talk about this? So he's doing it in kind of a fun, poetic way. So let's let him do it.
It's been so everywhere, you don't need a where. You don't even need a when. That's how every it gets. Forget this. I want to be something. Go somewhere. Do something. I want things to change. I want to invent time and space. And I know it's possible because everything is here and it probably already happened.
So, okay, and it probably already happened. That's very interesting. So what we're saying is that all of the energy that is now present in the universe was present in the initial singularity. And so all of the potentiality is there. And it probably already happened. That's maybe a nod to a conception of cyclical cosmology. I imagine that might be what he's talking about. The idea of big bangs and big crunches, which is not really any longer the model. It looks like more of a heat death in the sense of because dark energy is accelerating the expansion of the universe. It does not seem like, at least currently, given the data that we have access to, that a compression will occur. But that is a cosmology that has been believed by many cultures and was entertained by physics for a while as well, because we understood that if gravity is attracting all matter, then it was just had to do with understanding the density of the universe, the rate of expansion, and would the mass of everything in the universe be enough for a gravitational attraction to cause it to contract back on the initial singularity, and then it could be cyclical. That'd be crazy. But so yeah, we're just about to get going here.
I just don't know when to start, and that's exactly where it started. Oh, I paused it. I think there's a universe now. What's it made of?
Quarks and stuff.
Ah, that.
Right. So, there's an amount of energy that is associated with the initial singularity, and then due to matter and energy equivalence, the energy can congeal into matter. So the first matter that was there, we call it the quark gluon plasma. So quarks and stuff. We have a quark gluon plasma. Quarks are the components that make up nucleons, and then gluons are the particles that mediate, they're the bosons that mediate the strong nuclear force that's going to be able to bring quarks together to form baryons. So that this part is accurate, right? We have energy, and I love, like, go back and pause those couple of frames that are meant to represent the first, like, 10 to the negative 36 seconds after the singularity, because it's like, how are you going to visually represent that? You can't. So it's just absurd, and he did it in a very absurd way. So go back and look at those frames. It's very interesting. Okay, so we've got a quark gluon plasma. Here we go.
That's a thing in a place. Don't like it? Try a new place at a different time. Try to stick together, because the world is going to get bigger and emptier. But it's not empty yet. It's still very full and about a jillion degrees.
So I like that. So just everything is so fast, but it's just there's little dark matter right there. And so we already have mass. So gravity is a thing, and expansion is occurring. So what's the next bit, right? As it expands, the universe is cooling. It began 10 to the 50 Kelvin or something absolutely unthinkable. But as it cools, new things can be stable. And so new things are able to form. So about no seconds later, it says about no seconds later. And it's about no seconds later, because we're going from around 10 to the negative 36 seconds all the way to about 10 to the negative 12 seconds. We're talking about only a trillionth of a second after the initial singularity, where we begin to see symmetry breaking, right? That's where we start to see the electroweak epoch take shape. So many epochs occur in that first trillionth of a second. All of these symmetry breakings and really, really major events happen that we're still only at about no seconds later. That's what's crazy about cosmology.
Great news. The quarks are now happily married in groups of three, called a proton or a neutron. And there's something else flying around too that wants to join in but can't because it's still too...
it's so hot. Yeah, so first you have quarks and gluons. There's a quark gluon plasma, but when it cools enough, quarks are able to form. It's not just groups of three. So groups of three form baryons, and a quark and an antiquark form mesons, and so those are different kinds of hadrons. So hadrons can form when quarks when it's cool enough for quarks to couple, to come together. And so now we have most importantly we have baryons. So we have stable protons and neutrons. There are also electrons in this epoch, but it is still too hot for electrons to couple to protons and neutrons. So we can have nuclei, but we can't have neutral atoms yet. So you have this different kind of plasma. So you have quarks can come together to form protons and neutrons, but we still do not have neutral atoms, too hot for electrons to couple. About 10 minutes later, it says. So this is all following accurately the timeline proposed by cosmologists. That's what's really cool about this. It's just so comedic when you do it in this not really a matter-of-fact textbook way, but in this kind of comedic way. It just, like, amplifies the absurdity of the timelines that we're talking about here.
Great news. The protons and neutrons are now happily married to each other. Some of them even doubled up.
Great. So, yeah. So that now we're talking about Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So a certain duration of time, I forget, a certain number of minutes or hours, still very soon after the initial singularity, but it's still too hot for electrons to couple to nucleons, but it's hot enough for nucleons to fuse. So basically, the entire universe at that time is like the inside of a star today. So inside, so stars are plasma. It's too hot for electrons to couple to nucleons. So nucleons are whizzing around, but it's so hot, there's so much gravitational pressure inwards that nucleons can fuse. And during Big Bang nucleosynthesis, the entire universe was like that. The entire universe was like the inside of a star, like the core of a star. And so from hydrogen, you got a lot of helium. And a little bit of lithium. You did get a trace amounts of lithium. So that's part of what corroborates Big Bang cosmology. There's different threads. There is the cosmic microwave background radiation. There is the recession velocities of galaxies. But there's also the distribution of hydrogen and helium. It's about 75% hydrogen, 25% helium. That is specifically predicted by the model. You can calculate the temperature differential from when Big Bang nucleosynthesis should start and when it should end, that duration of time, however many minutes it was, I don't remember off the top of my head, minutes or hours, I'm not sure, but you can calculate how much helium should have been synthesized in that time, and we look around the universe, and that's what we see. So that's a third, we're talking about three independent threads of evidence where we're predicting something on the basis of Big Bang cosmology, and then we look out in the universe and we can confirm all of those things. So that's, you know, when people talk about, oh, Big Bang, blah, 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 so silly. So like, no, like you just don't understand the evidence that's supporting it. But so anyway, we have, we have different nuclei, hydrogen and helium and a little bit of lithium nuclei. And now it said 380,000 years later. So we're gearing up for the recombination era. This is when it's finally cool enough for electrons to couple to atomic nuclei. And once they do so, if you remember your Bohr model from 10th grade chemistry, the electron can inhabit different energy levels. And when it relaxes down to the ground state, it emits photons. So this is actually the first time 380,000 years into the history of the universe that the universe becomes transparent. The electromagnetic radiation can travel freely through the universe. And that is actually what the cosmic microwave background radiation is. It is what was produced in this instant where electrons finally could couple to atomic nuclei and then all relax to the ground state simultaneously all over the universe, releasing this radiation that has been stretched and cooled since that time to the 1.4 Kelvin or whatever it is now, which is specifically predicted by the model and corroborated when we look out into the universe in the 1960s. That was kind of the main thread of evidence that made us kind of really have to accept Big Bang cosmology as undeniably corroborated, undeniably consistent beyond reasonable doubt as a model of the development of the universe. So here we are. We've got our nuclei. It's about to do recombination. Let's do it.
Great news. The electrons have now joined in. Congratulations. The world is now a bunch of gas in space. But it's getting closer together. And it's getting closer together. And it's getting closer together. It's a star. New shit just got made.
To get that last one. So, okay, we just went through a billion years, but it's just so funny that way. I love just like new shit just got made. But that's astrophysics, right? What we're saying is now we have neutral hydrogen and helium, mostly. That's mostly what we have, and that's gas. So we hydrogen and helium gas, and that's pretty much all that there is in the universe. But because of gravity, that starts to collect. And then once you have a region of gas that's becomes denser and denser and denser, you have a lot of mass in that cloud, that begins to condense. And then the gravitational pressure inwards becomes so strong that it triggers that nuclear fusion is able to happen, which then causes the star to glow. So that's what a star is, right? You have this cloud of gas, at least exclusively hydrogen and helium gas for the first generation of stars, which made the first galaxies. And once it's so much mass that is converging, the gravitational pressure inwards is so immense that the nuclei whiz around and are able to fuse. And when they fuse, there's that mass defect. Some of that mass is converted into energy, and that energy goes outwards. So you have this battle between gravitational pressure crushing inwards and nuclear fusion pushing outwards. That's what a star is. And once you have a star, where all these nuclei are fusing in the core of the star, and that's where you get everything up to iron. So when it says new shit just got made, that's the first time, only once stars formed, were we able to get carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and neon and silicon all the way up to iron. Iron is the limit because the greatest binding energy per nucleon. It's the most stable atomic nucleus. In other words, it's releasing energy as you get up to iron. But if you were to synthesize beyond that, it would require more energy output, more energy input than would be released. So it's not energetically favorable to continuously synthesize past iron, something like that. That might not be exactly right. But I go over this in my astronomy content. The first 4 or 5 videos are cosmology and then stars and galaxies and all of this stuff that we're talking about. So now we have our first generation of stars, and they've been fusing other elements in their cores. So let's see where we get now.
Some stars burn out and die. Bigger stars burn out and die with passion and make some brand new, way crazier shit.
So, right. So now we're talking about, we have all the stars of different sizes because the mass of the cloud, the mass of the gas cloud that forms them determines the mass of the star, and that determines the fate of the star. Right below the Chandrasekhar limit, if it's the core is 1.5 solar masses, right, just going by our sun's mass, which is arbitrary. But if it's a smaller star, it's going to form a white dwarf. But if it's a larger star, it can form either a neutron star as a remnant or a black hole. And in either case, it's going to die in a supernova, a glorious supernova, which is going to spew all of that, all of those new elements out into space. And so not only what was synthesized internally in the core of the star, but in a supernova event, all of the elements beyond, iron, at least iron all the way up to uranium, I believe, is the heaviest. I think the trans uranium are the ones that are purely synthetic that we make in particle accelerators. That might not be exactly right, but it's right around there, the limit. And so these other exotic events like a supernova are going to form everything from everything heavier than iron. But now all of that is being ejected into space to form new clouds. So that's space dust. So when astronomers say gas and dust, gas means hydrogen and helium. Dust means everything else. So when you have a cloud of dust, it means still a lot of hydrogen and helium, but lots of other elements as well. So we've got space dust now. Space
dust, which allows newer, more interesting stars to be made and then die and explode into
even crazier space dust.
So now stars have cool stuff around them, like rocks, ice, and funny clouds, which can make some very interesting things.
Okay, so now we just did solar system development in like 3 seconds. So the point is, when all the universe had was hydrogen and helium, when a star was forming, that's all you could get was a star. But now we have all of this dust everywhere. When there's new dust, it can collect again by gravity. It's distributed around. You get a new star, but that protoplanetary disk, when that protoplanetary disk forms to get a new star, all of these other elements are there. And so now planets can form. So planets could not form around the first generation of stars. Only in later generations of stars that were the protoplanetary disk had was seeded with all these other elements, then you could get actual solar systems. And so the bulk of the protoplanetary disk is going to condense into the central star, but all of this other material can also condense at these various orbital radii from the sun and make planets and then also moons around the planets. And so these can have tremendously varying compositions. In our system, and therefore probably many other systems, the inner planets tend to be rockier. And so this is just the way that elements partition in the protoplanetary disk, right? Depending on mass and density, different elements and different substances will partition differently. There'll be a gradient as you move outwards in the protoplanetary disk, and that informs the composition of the planets that form. So you have these inner rocky planets, you have the outer gas giants. That seems to be quite likely to be a trend with solar system formation. It may not be in every system, but I think that seems to be the case. So now we have solar systems. It looks like we're going to our solar system, which does skip a little bit because we're talking about the first generation of stars died out really quickly. Those are the POP 3, I think we would say that is. And so very quickly we had stars that could have planets around them. But our star is POP 1, I believe, which means very recent. And so our star came about, and our system came about around 10 billion years after the initial singularity. So we're talking about well into the lifetime of the universe. It's about 13.7, 13.8 billion total. So 10 in. So we skipped 6 or 7 billion years in those few seconds. But now we have our solar system. So let's see where we go here.
Like this ball of flaming rocks, for example. Holy shit, we just got hit with another ball of flaming rocks. And it kind of made a mess, which is weather up.
So that event, so in when solar systems are forming, it's a very chaotic system. So it's not like it is now, right? Billions of years later, everything has kind of stabilized. There's very few, relatively few bodies, because all these smaller bodies are constantly colliding and fusing to make larger bodies, larger planets and things. But in the beginning, as the solar system is forming, it's a lot of bodies. It's very chaotic. Everything is perturbing everything else and colliding. And so Theia was a rocky body that collided with the early Earth. And so that did a couple of things. Number one, the collision explains the tilt in Earth's rotational axis. So in a protoplanetary disk, due to conservation of angular momentum, everything is going to be orbiting the same way and everything is going to be rotating the same way. But when collision events occur, that can easily change. And so that's why you have some planets where the rotational axis is completely on its side, perpendicular to the plane of the solar system. Parallel rather than perpendicular, I should say. So for Earth, it got tilted 20-something degrees because of that impact event with Theia. And then that collision caused a bunch of the Earth. It just made a gigantic mess. And a lot of the material that was in the crust of the Earth spread out around the Earth and began to orbit the Earth and then slowly collected to form the moon. So that's why the moon is actually made of material that was the crust of the Earth. So the moon and the Earth are kind of made of the same stuff. So now we have our moon and we've got a weather update.
Weather update. It's raining rocks from outer space. Weather update. Those rocks might have had water inside them and now there's hot steam in the sky. Weather update. Cooler temperatures today and the floor is no longer lava. Weather update. It's raining. Severe flooding alert. The entire world is now an ocean.
Okay, so... yeah, so our oceans came from impact events as well. A lot of comets, I believe. And so it sounds pretty crazy because there's so much water here, but comets can be very big. They can carry a lot of water, and there were a lot of collision events. And so at first when that happened in the Hadean epoch, it was very, very, very hot. So you just had a lot of steam. But water can't escape out, once it's here in Earth's atmosphere, it's here. And so it cooled down sufficiently that it was able to precipitate. And now all of a sudden from the Hadean, we're now in the Archean and, we have a lot of water. It's really, the Earth is really, really almost entirely covered with water. So what happens next?
Volcano alert.
That's land.
There's life in the ocean.
What?
Something's alive in the ocean.
Oh, cool, like a plant or an animal? No, a microscopic speck. It lives at the bottom of the ocean and eats chemical soup, which is being served.
Okay, so, yeah. So, I mean, this is, you can totally, he's doing this so fast, so we're not going to, like, do a biogenesis justice here. he portrayed something that looked like a bacterium. Obviously, that's not the first thing that was alive, number one. Number two, the hydrothermal vent model seems to probably not be the most viable candidate for abiogenesis, much more likely to be something like a hot spring or a tidal pool model. But, you know, we don't know for sure. So, you know, it certainly could be a hydrothermal vent. Don't tell James Tour. We've got some chemical soup. I know that he hates soup. but of course, soup just means water with molecules in it. So we've got organic molecules that, there's no way to... if he had thrown abiogenesis in the mix and tried to actually do that justice, this would have, it would have added another 5 minutes to this video. So anyway, we'll take the abiogenesis as rendered, and we've arrived at simple microorganisms in the soup, as we like to say.
Being served hot and fresh, made from gnarly space ingredients left over from when it was raining rocks or whatever. Oh yeah, and it can do that. It has secret instructions written inside itself telling it how to build another one of itself. So that's pretty nifty, I would say. Tired of living at the bottom of the ocean? Now you can eat sunlight. Using a revolutionary technique, you can convert sunlight into food. Taste the sun. Side effect, now there's oxygen everywhere and the sky's blue. Then the...
Right, so, yeah, so... Great. So you have all of these microorganisms, and so you have unicellular. There was a very long period of time, a couple billion years, probably at least a billion. I think a couple billion, where life was entirely unicellular, but it began to develop these different abilities, and so photosynthesis was one such ability. So first you had prokaryotic life, but then you had endosymbiosis events where larger prokaryotes were able to engulf smaller prokaryotes and then kind of merge and become an individual organism. So now you have eukaryotic unicellular life. And depending on certain abilities that different prokaryotes were able to develop because of evolution, so you have different mutations that yield different enzymes that can do different things. And so you have different metabolic behaviors, different metabolic abilities. And so now all of a sudden you have eukaryotic unicellular organisms that are capable of things like photosynthesis. And so a byproduct of photosynthesis is oxygen. So prior to this, Earth's atmosphere had almost no oxygen, but then you had this great oxidation from photosynthetic unicellular organisms that covered the Earth with oxygen. And that paved the way for more complex metabolic behavior, because prior to that, so cellular respiration, the three-step process that we know of, that is how animals, it's a higher ATP yielding metabolic process, was only possible once the atmosphere was oxygenated, because oxygen is the last electron acceptor in the electron transport chain in cellular respiration, in aerobic respiration. And so now all of a sudden, this is a huge paradigm shift for the Earth, right? You have the atmosphere is oxygenated, and now there's the possibility for much more robust energy production, which means that now you can have multicellular life that can move around, and you can have cell differentiation, organs and different things can evolve. So let's check it out.
Then the Earth might have been a snowball for a while, maybe even a couple of times. It's a sponge, it's a plant, it's a worm, and some other types of weird, strange water bugs and strange fish. It's the Cambrian
explosion. So that's pretty accurate, right? I mean, it's the first animals were almost certainly sponges. That's the coanoflagellate hypothesis, where you have these colonial unicellular organisms that just eventually become an individual organism. And there are the collar cells in sponges very closely resemble these coanoflagellate colonies. So there's a lot of evidence that suggests that sponges were the first animals. And then he pretty accurately showed this progression here. I mean, he skipped a lot. He has to. But these organisms that he's showing are accurately the Ediacaran fauna. This is still the Precambrian. So there were animals. There certainly were animals prior to the Cambrian explosion. And And many of them show forms that carried over across the Cambrian explosion. So I don't remember if how he depicts the actual Cambrian explosion, but we're not there yet. I think this is supposed to be the explosion because that might be a trilobite down there. But there's and this is that a Wiwaxia or something? That one with the stuff coming off it on the bottom. I don't remember the name, but I do definitely remember it from doing the Stephen Meyer debunk, because he's the one who lies about the Cambrian explosion all day. So we've got really cool animals. That's where we're at. All in the water, but really cool animals.
Wow, that's animals and stuff. But we're still in the ocean. Hey, can we go on land?
No.
Why?
The sun is a deadly laser.
Oh, okay.
Not anymore, there's a blanket.
Now the animal.
So, right. So, in earlier stages of Earth's atmosphere, UV light was very, very penetrative, right? So the ozone layer that blocked a lot of the UV light. So mutation rates would have been very, very, very high. And so that could have actually been beneficial for an abiogenesis event, because you needed all of that genetic diversity with early stuff, and RNA didn't have the replicative fidelity of DNA anyway. But now that we've got very complex multicellular life, you can't tinker too much with the mutation rate. If you go way too many mutations, you're going to lose what you have. So only once you have this ozone layer, because remember, you've got photosynthetic organisms that are continuously oxygenating the atmosphere, and ozone is an allotrope of oxygen. It's O3 instead of O2, right? Molecular oxygen in the atmosphere is O2, but you also have O3. And so that, once you had sufficient ozone, and that is blocking a good amount of the UV rays, that made it such that animal life could get onto land and live there. So now we're going to see, I think, the first tetrapods make their way onto land.
Now the animals can go on land. Come on, animals, let's go on land. Nope, can't walk yet. And there's no food yet, so I don't care. Okay, will you learn to walk if there's plants up here? Maybe, said some bugs and fish.
I like that. That is true that insects actually came onto land before tetrapods, and plants as well. I mean, plants first. I'm almost certain, right? There has to be plant life for animals to feed on, because plants are going to be the primary producers. Plants can get on land without any source of food, because they're feeding from the sun, making their own food from sunlight, and so then you have insects, and then I love that, like, that's supposed to be like an ancestor of Tiktaalik or something. That's just because the fins, this is the development of sarcopterygians. So the lobe-finned fish, it was a very slow and gradual process by which fins became these sort of pseudo limbs that could kind of drag around the floor, the shallow ocean floor. And then they just slowly evolved into actual appendages that would allow them to kind of crawl onto land. And you know, it's creationists like to scoff at that. And I always say, look at mud skippers. You know what I mean? Like, they do that shit today. They kind of hobble around and jump around and walk on land in a mediocre way, I suppose. So that's somewhat analogous to what the early sarcopterygians would have been like. And so Tiktaalik and some of these other Acanthostega, I forget some of the names of them, but there are many different species that we have. The fossil record is fairly robust, going from the early sarcopterygians to the early land tetrapods. And so that's going to yield amphibians first, and then reptiles, and then mammals. So let's get through that.
Okay, so I can go on land, but I have to go back in the water to
have babies.
Learn to use an egg.
I was already doing that.
Use a stronger egg. Put water in it. Have a baby on land in an egg. Water.
Right. So that's the birth of amniotes. Right. So the amniotic egg. This is actually an unbelievable evolutionary innovation, because all life needed water, lived in water, and needed to give birth in water. And so what nature figured out how to do is to have an egg with water in it that could be laid on land. And so all of a sudden, and it's very interesting with plant life too, how the first, like the bryophytes and, mosses and things also had to be right near water. And it was the advent of gymnosperms, that allowed for, new strategies, reproductive strategies that finally allowed plants to be far away from water. And so that's when forests began to cover the land and things like that. But so the amniotic egg, that's an incredible a step in evolution, so that animals can lay eggs, not right. It doesn't have to be in the water. It could be somewhere else. So now we have amniotes. Now we have reptiles.
Water is in the egg. Baby in the egg, in the water, in the egg. Works for me.
Bye-bye, ocean.
And now everything's huge. Including bugs. Want to see a map of the land? Sure. Oh, fuck. Now everything's dead. Just kidding. Here are the survivors. Keep your eye on this one because it's about to become the dinosaurs. Here's another map of the land. Yeah, it broke apart. Don't worry about it. It does that all the time. Here comes a meteor.
And the dinosaurs are gone.
We just covered to the dinosaur, the entire era of the dinosaurs in about 4 seconds, but it's good and it works. It's just fun. It's accurate and fun and funny. So we had, I like that part about everything's getting bigger. So at first there was sort of an evolutionary arms race because of how heavily oxygenated, I believe, the atmosphere was. Something about the atmosphere of the time that really allowed, animals to get very large, including insects. That was the era where you had these dragonflies that were the size of like a freaking car or something, or I don't remember exactly how big, but they're just unbelievably huge. Maybe not the size of a car, but just crazy big. And then there were various extinctions, right? So there was that great dying event, the Permian Triassic extinction, I believe it's called. It's also known as the Great Dying. That's where something in the ballpark of 90% of life died. And so I believe that was what sort of paved the way for the era of the dinosaurs, which thrived for a very, very, very long time. 150 million years or something like that. And then we now know pretty firmly that it was an impact, asteroid, comet, I forget, an impact event that caused the extinction of the dinosaurs. So now will be the rise of the mammals. There were already mammals, but they were very small. Now with the dinosaurs gone, we can us mammals can thrive.
It's mammal time. Here come the mammals. Look at those breasts. Now they're gonna dominate the world, and one of them just learned how to grab stuff and walk. No, like walk like that and grab stuff at the same time. And bang rocks together to make pointed rocks.
It's just so fast. It's just like whiplash from this shit. But it's true. You had small mammals and then, skipping a lot to get to, something to get to. We're going through all of biological anthropology or old world monkeys and then apes. And then we're getting to the lineage where the last common ancestor between humans and chimps sort of branches off. And we're going up the hominid branch. And so I actually do like how that was described. It's so fast and so succinct, but we're talking about we're talking about Australopithecines that are beginning to walk upright, but they still can maneuver in the trees. So these are the morphologies. These are morphological, or I should say anatomical characteristics that clue us in to hominid evolution and how these organisms certainly were not chimps and were not humans. They have these intermediary characteristics where they're bipedal, but they have their arms and things are very clearly for moving around in the trees. And so this is all happening in Africa. And the impetus for this is that, hominids were moving around in trees, but then there's sort of a climatic shift and the biome shifted towards savanna, where you have these long sort of empty stretches in between tree-filled regions. So they've got these canopies and there's a high premium on being able to climb around in trees and get around in trees, but they also have to be able to traverse these large open sections of savanna where they are very vulnerable to predators. So you've got all kinds of different, you know, large cats and things like that that can very easily kill Australopithecines. So there becomes a high premium also on being able to run really fast. And so bipedality evolved out of necessity to be able to traverse safely to these savanna regions. But they still needed to be able to climb around trees. And then as evolution continued, it became less tree-centric. And now we are getting to the genus Homo. I don't remember. I don't think there are Australopithecines that were using stone tools. That may or may not be correct. But I know, obviously, that multiple Homo species were using tools. So tool use predates Homo sapiens. That absolutely is known. And so here we go. Now we're getting into early human prehistory. We're transitioning from biological anthropology into archaeology. We're going to start getting to the earliest civilizations.
Ouch, and set things on fire. Youch, and make crazy sounds with their voice. Which can mean different things.
That's a human person.
And now they're everywhere. Almost.
Ice Age.
What? You can walk over here? Cool.
Not anymore.
Well, I guess we're stuck here now. Let's review. There's people on the planet. And they're chasing their food. Fuck it. Time to plant some grass. Look at this. I control the food now. Now everyone will want to be my friend and live near me. Let's all build houses, except mine is bigger because I own the food.
Okay, so we've gotten all the way up to agriculture. So we've got to early civilization. So early Holocene, we're talking about just past the most recent ice age. And so right after the Younger Dryas, you have this global climatic shift. Prior to that, the climate was too unstable to very reliably farm anything. But globally, we see agriculture emerge in the early Holocene all over the world because of this global climatic shift, and then also because this information can be shared. People can migrate. Merchants can bring seeds and stuff. So you have this emergence of agriculture. That's happening, and this begins to pave the way for large-scale civilization. And when you have less of a hunter-gatherer focused society, you have very localized civilization. That's when you begin to see social hierarchy evolve. You begin to see the emergence of the concept of the possession of property, along that marriage, things like that. So this is an enormous shift in the way humans behaved when we start to see these early civilizations. So we're going to start talking about Sumer, Babylon, that kind of stuff.
This is great. I wonder if anyone else is doing this. Tired of using rocks for everything? Use metal. It's underground. Better farming was just invented in a sweet, dank valley right in between these two rivers, and the animals are helping.
Guess what happens next?
More food, and more people who came to buy the food. Now you need people to help make the food and keep track of the sales. And now you need houses for people to live in and people to make the houses. And now there's more people and they invent things, which makes things better. And more people come and there's more farming and more people to make more things for more people. And now there's business, money, writing, laws, power.
Society.
It's so funny and overly reductive, but strangely accurate, right? This is what it is, right? You have agriculture, you have the ability to grow much larger amounts of food that can sustain more people. So the people are going to go to where the food is, and then they need to be housed. And then the very complicated social dynamics arise. So there has to be the development of laws. If all of these people are going to live in this small space, which has never happened before in human history, we have to have rules such that we can all coexist in this space, have access to the food, things like that. It's remarkably complicated, but then when you zoom out and get really just, it is that simple, right? Everything is simple, and then you learn more about it, and it gets very, very, very complicated, and then you zoom out even further, and it's kind of simple again. That's the bizarre thing about, in particular, human history, but it's incredible. So, yes, we're at Sumer here, I believe, is what's being depicted.
Coming soon to a dank river valley near you. Meanwhile, out in the middle of nowhere, the horse is probably being tamed. Why is all my metal so lame and lumpy? Tired of using lame, sad metal? Introducing bronze, made with special ingredient tin from the far lands of Tinland. I don't know, my dealer won't tell me where he gets it. Also, guess what? Egypt. Meanwhile, out in the middle of nowhere, they figured out how to put wheels on a horse. Now we're getting somewhere. Also, China. And did I mention Indus River Valley
Civilization? Like, entire civilizations are just Egypt. But we're going so fast, right? Each second is 1,000 years. So that's how fast we're going. I mean, not 1,000, but I mean, it's really, really moving. Okay, society count. Let's check it out.
The Middle East is getting more complicated. Maybe because it's in the middle of the East. Knock, knock, or clop, clop. It's the people with the horses. And they made an empire. And then everyone else copied their horses.
Greeks!
Ah, look, it must be the Greeks, or a beta version of the Greeks. Let's check in with the Indus River Valley civilization. They're gone.
Beta version. So you have, like, Minoan and Mycenaean civilizations, which are Greek, but they predate classical Greece by a good amount, 1,000 or 2,000 years or something. So that's uneventful. I mean, there's a lot going on, but not compared to the classical Greece that we're familiar with. And then pivot to Indus Valley really quickly.
They're gone. Guess who's not gone?
China. New arrivals in India. Maybe it's those horse people I was talking about, or their cousins or something. And they wrote some hymns and mantras and stuff.
You could make a religion out of this. There's the Bronze Age collapse.
Now the Phoenicians can get down to business.
Also, can we switch to a metal that's a little easier to find? Thanks. Look who came back to Israel. It's the 12 tribes of Israel.
And they believe in God.
Just one, though. He's got like a 10-step program. Here's some huge heads.
That's great. I mean, they just... You're going from Bronze Age to Iron Age just by saying iron, and then now we have monotheism. Monotheism is a thing. Okay, now let's check out. So the Olmecs are the earliest civilization in this region.
Must be the Olmecs. The Phoenicians make some colonies. The Greeks copy their idea and make some colonies. The Phoenicians made a colony so big it makes colonies. Here comes the Assyrian Empire. Never mind, it's the Babylonian Median.
It's the Persian Empire.
Wow, that's big. Ah, the Buddha was just enlightened. Who's the Buddha? This guy, who sat under a tree for so long that he figured out how to ignore the fact that we're all dying. You can make a religion out of this. Oops, China just broke, but while it was breaking, Confucius was figuring out how to have good morals. Ah, the Greeks just had the idea of thinking about stuff. And right over here, Alexander just had the idea of conquering the entire Persian Empire. It's a great...
We did classical Greece in about a half a second, and it was summarized as the idea of thinking about stuff. It's just beautiful. It's just perfect. If you're going to summarize classical Greece in half a second, that is what you would say. Just the headiness of that civilization, and that it was sort of the backbone of Western thought for a couple thousand, right? Aristotelian logic was the paradigm of logic until the Phrygian Revolution, like 100 years ago or something, right? Something like that. That's how much of a mark classical Greece made on Western civilization. What was the other thing I was going to say? I can't remember. It's just going way too fast. Alexander the Great. So now we are in Hellenistic Greece. And now it's just like this is kind of the interesting thing about, and this is something that I noticed when I was doing the antiquity portion of my world history content, is it when you kind of zoom out, it's just they conquered this, they conquered that, they conquered this, they conquered that. And it's kind of ridiculous. Like when you zoom way out and play it on fast forward, you miss all the nuance of all the different cultures and everything, but it is just kind of like my land, my land, my land, my land. And human history was fucking like that until like 100 years ago. And honestly, and it's not over, right? We're still seeing that in the Middle East. We're still seeing that type of colonialism being acted out in the fucking 21st century, which is bananas. But in that era, it was par for the course. That's just what everything was, is just taking over everything that you can. And then it's someone else's turn when you run out of steam. So Alexander the Great obviously did that a lot. I mean, more than almost anybody, I guess maybe Genghis Khan. But Alexander the Great conquered a very, very impressive kingdom there for Hellenistic Greece.
It's a great idea. He was great. And now he's dead. Hopefully the rest of the gang will be able to share the empire evenly between them. Knock, knock, it's Chandragupta. He says, get the hell out of here. Will you get the hell out of here if I give you 500 elephants? Okay, thanks, bye.
Time to conquer all of India. coast of India.
But what about this part? That's the Tamil Kings. No one conquers the Tamil Kings. Who are the Tamil Kings?
Merchants, probably. And they've got spices.
Who would like to buy the spices? Me, said the Arabian, swiftly buying it and selling it to the rest of the world. Hey, China put itself back together again, with good morals as their main philosophy. Actually, they have three main philosophies. Out here, the horse nomads run wild and free, and they would like to ransack your city. Let's check the Greekification levels of the Greekified kingdoms. Greekification overload. Bye, said the Parthians. Bye, said the Jews. Hi, said the Parthians, taking over the entire place. Hey, said the Romans, eating the entire Mediterranean for breakfast. Thanks for invading our homeland, said the Jews, who were starting to get tired of people invading their homeland. Hi, everything's great, said some guy who seems to be getting very popular and is then arrested and killed for being too popular, which only makes him more popular. You can make a religion out of this. Want silk? Now you can buy it from China.
I love "you can make a religion out of this" is just the catchphrase every time he summarizes the development of a new religion in about a second. It's pretty great. Okay, Silk Road.
They just made a
brand new road to the world. Or you can get their own water.
Sick, new trade routes, said India, accidentally spreading their religion to the entire southeast. That's a good place for an epic trading kingdom. There goes Buddhism, traveling up the Silk Road. I wonder if it'll reach China before it collapses again. Remember the Persian Empire? Yep, said the Persians, making a new one. Axum is getting so powerful they would like to build a long stick. Has anyone populated Madagascar yet? Let's do it together.
China's home again. Then it broke again.
Still can't cross the Sahara Desert? Try camels.
Hell yeah, now we got business,
said the Ghana Empire, selling lots of gold and slaves. Hi, I live in the Roman Empire, and I was wondering,
is loving Jesus legal yet?
No. Actually, okay, sure, said Constantine, moving the capital way over here to be closer to his main
rival.
Don't worry about Rome, it won't fall.
It's the golden age.
It's just like, my God, like the summary, it's just such breakneck speed. Right, the persecution of Christians and then the adoption of Christianity as the official language for the Roman Empire, and then the splintering into Western Eastern, right, so moving over to Constantinople, and having the Byzantine Empire, and it's just like, it's just going so freaking fast, it's so hard to keep up.
There's the Gupta Empire, not Chandragupta, just Gupta, first name Chandra, the first. Guess who's in Rome?
Barbarians.
What's a barbarian? Non-Romans, said the Romans, being invaded by non-Romans. R.I.P. Roman Empire.
That's a great, like, this is one a thing I like to talk about, right? Just this, the politicization of, so the non-Romans are barbarians, right? Kind of like Native Americans are savages, and like the language of the colonizer. So it's like in the West, we have this favorable view of the Roman Empire. And so, you know, it's, you can do the Monty Python thing. What have the Romans ever done for us? Oh, you know, roads and the aqueduct and yes, that's a byproduct of an empire is urbanization, and there's useful results there, but it's also just the massacring of various indigenous peoples, and the political justification of it, right? They're barbarians. The Gauls are barbarians. So we should, you know, take their land, you know, it belongs to us. We're Rome. We should get to rule the entire world. And that mentality is alive and well today, sadly. I don't know that we will ever see a time where human beings aren't like that, but it's not here yet.
Actually, just half of it. The other half is just fine, but it's not in Rome anymore. So let's give it a new name.
The Mayans have figured out the stars.
Oh, and here's a huge city. Population, everyone. The Gok Turks have taken over the entire Eurasian steppe. Great job, Gok Turks. How's India? Broken. How's China?
Back together.
How's those trading kingdoms?
Bigger and there's more of them.
Korea has three kingdoms. Japan has a kingdom. It's the Sunrise Kingdom. Deep in the Arabian Desert, on the top of a mountain, the real God whispers in Muhammad's ear. So he goes down to the cube where everyone worships gods, and he tells them their gods are all fake. And everyone got so mad at him that he had to leave town and go to a different town. You can make a religion out of this, and maybe conquer the world as well. The Roman Empire is long gone, but somehow the Pope is still the Pope. Plus there's
new kingdoms all over Europe.
I wonder if there's room for Moors. Here's all the wisdom. In a house. It's the Baghdad House of Wisdom. Just in time for the
Islamic Golden Age.
Let's bring stuff to the coast and sell it and become the Swahili on the Swahili coast, said the Swahili on the Swahili coast. Remember this tiny space you have to go through to get from here to there? Someone owns that now. Want to get enlightened in the middle of nowhere? The Franks have the biggest kingdom in Europe, and the Pope is so proud that he invites the king over for Christmas. Surprise, you're the new Roman Emperor, said the Pope, pretending to still be part of the Roman Empire. Then the Franks broke their kingdom.
Like, the definitely not the Roman Empire. This is starting to get very, very difficult to comment on because it's just so rapid. It's literally like a tenth of a second per kingdom, right? They're just like, there's some kingdoms, and it's all accurate, and it's actually very thorough, right? It really is covering almost everything, just a tenth of a second each, right? Each of those things could be a 20-minute, a 30-minute, an hour-long video, history video, detailing the development of that particular empire and its relations with its neighbors and everything. And he's doing it literally in a tenth of a second, which is the point of the video. It's beautiful, but it's crazy to watch.
Kingdom into what will later be called France and not France. The Northerners, or just Norse if you don't have much time, are exploring. They go north, from the north to the northern north, and they find some land, two types of land, and they name them accordingly. They also invade some other places and get called many names, such as Vikings. There's the Rus, the Kievan Rus. Are they Vikings? I don't think so, said the Kievan Rus. Okay, fair enough. The Pope is ready to make some more emperors of the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire. It's actually Germany, but don't worry about it. New kingdoms.
Christianize all the kingdoms.
Which brand would you like? Mine's better. Mine's better. Mine's better. Time to conquer England, said William. It's a bird. It's a plane.
So many wars, so much strife, and it's it's abbreviated as mine's better, mine's better, mine's better, mine's better, which is accurate. It's pretty great.
It's a plane.
It's the Seljuk Turks,
said the Byzantine Empire, who's getting so small it almost doesn't exist anymore. We need help. They need help. So they call the Pope. Hey, Pope, can you help us get rid of the Seljuks? Maybe take back the Holy Land on the way? Come on, I know you want to take back the Holy Land. Yes, I do actually want to do that. Let's do a crusade.
Crusade!
They did many crusades, some of which almost didn't fail, but at least the Italians got some sweet trade deals. Goodbye, Mayans.
Hello, Toltecs.
Goodbye, Toltecs.
Hello, Mississippi.
Look at those mounds. There's the Pueblo. I always wondered how to build a town in a cliff. Guess who's here? Come here. Where? Here. And Pagan is there. Vietnam unconquered itself, Korea just became itself, and Japan is so addicted to art that the military might have to take over the government. China just invented bombs and typing. And the Mongols just invaded most of the universe. Nice going, Genghis. I bet that will last a long time. Some of the Islamic Turks were unaffected by the Mongol invasions because they were busy invading India. Is it Tonga time? I think it's Tonga time. I just found out where the Swahili gets all their gold. Look at this Chad. Means lake. There's an empire there. Right in the middle of... The king of Mali is so rich he's going on tour to let everyone know. Wow, that guy's rich, everyone said. The Christians are doing a great job reconquering Iberia, which will soon be called Spain and not Spain. Please remain Christian. We will check in later to see if you're still Christian when you least expect. Whoops, half of Europe just died. China's back, yay! Hey, come here, time to share. New kingdoms here and there. Oh, look who controls all the islands. It's the Mahajapit. Majahapit. Mapajahit. Mahapajit. Mapajahit. Majapahit. Oh, Italy's really rich. Time for them to care a lot about art and the ancient classics. It's kind of like a rebirth. Here's a printer. Let's make books. So you think you can conquer the Byzantine Empire? Yep, said the Ottoman Turks. Nice job, Ottoman Turks. Oops, you missed a spot. Don't forget to ban Europe from the Indian spice trade.
What? It's crazy. It's just so fast. And he puts in the date, right? 14, whatever it was, when the Ottomans conquered Constantinople. It's just like, holy shit, where are we? Like, we did the Renaissance in a second. What's really interesting about this too, though, like, obviously it hits all of the world history that we know, but there's so much, like, Tonga time. What the fuck is Tonga time? I know what Tonga is, but I don't know anything about, like, Tonga doing whatever it did in the South Pacific. I mean, it's like, to the point where I'm planning out the world history content post Middle Ages, and it's like I could look at this to just make a list of what I need to cover. It gives me zero information, but I know that whatever Bill Wirtz references is a thing that happened in world history and should be covered, right? I mean, it's like it's going to be daunting to move on after the Middle Ages, but it's just like, holy crap, there's so much happened in world history, and to see it condensed like this is crazy. I'm going to have probably not as much to say for the next couple of minutes. Let's see where we get.
What? That's bullshit, said Portugal, spiceless.
Well, I guess we'll have to find another way to India.
Wait, said Christopher Columbus, probably smoking crack. If the world is round, let's go this way to India. No, don't worry, we already got this, said Portugal. So Chris goes to Spain. Hey, Spain, want to hire me to find India by going around back of the world? No, please, no, please, no, please. Okay. So he sails into the ocean and discovers more ocean. And then discovers the Indies and Japan. Let's draw a line to decide who gets which half of the world. The Aztec and Inca empires are off to a great start. I wonder if they know that Europe just discovered their continent. The Habsburgs are marrying into so many royal families, they might have to start marrying each other. Move over, Lithuania. Here comes Moscow. Ivan wants to make Russia great again. Move over, Timurids. Maybe go invade India or something. Persia just made Persia Persian again. Let's make it the other kind of Islam. The one where we thought the first guy should have been the other guy. Hey, Christians, do you sin? Now you can buy your way out of hell. That's bullshit. This whole thing is bullshit. That's a scam. Fuck the church. Here's 95 Reasons Why, said Martin Luther in his new book, which might have accidentally started the Protestant Reformation. You know what would be magnificent, said Suleiman, wearing an onion hat? What if the Ottoman Empire was really big, which it is now? What if Russia was big, said Ivan, trying not to be terrible? Portugal had a dream that they controlled the entire Indian Ocean, including the spice trade. And then that dream was real. And Spain realized that this is not India, but they pillaged it anyway. Damn, said England and France. We gotta start pillaging some stuff. Then the Dutch revolt and all the hipsters moved to Amsterdam. Damn, said Amsterdam. We gotta start pillaging some stuff. Question 1. Can you get to India through North America? No, but at least there's beaver. Question 2. Steal the spice trade. That's not a question, but the Dutch did it anyway. Sugar. Guess where all the sugar's made? In Brazil.
Stolen.
In the Caribbean. And it's so goddamn profitable, you might forget to not do slavery. The next thing on Russia's to-do list is to get bigger. Britain and France are having a friendly discussion about who should control the entire world. More specifically, Ohio. Then it escalates into a 7-year discussion, giving Prussia a chance to show Austria who's boss. But what about Britain and France? Did they figure out who's boss? Yes, they did. It's Britain. Guess who's broke? Also Britain. So they start taxing the hell out of America. Fuck you, says America, declaring their independence and fighting for it. And France?
Fuck you, says America. That's a very apt description here. I like the... It's... Western imperialism almost looks adorable when described this way, right? It's so... I mean, it's the correct way to condense this and do it really quickly. And it's almost just like, hey, they're pillaging, they're pillaging, they're pillaging. It's exactly what happened. But it's like quaint when described this way almost.
This helps them win. Now France is broke. And Britain will have to send their prisoners to a different continent. Wait, if France is broke, why do the king and queen still wear such fancy dresses? Let's overthrow the palace and cut all their heads off, said Robespierre, cutting everybody's head off until someone eventually got mad and cut his head off. You can make a relit. No, don't. Haiti is starting to like the idea of a revolution, especially the slaves, who free themselves by killing their masters. Why didn't we think of this before? Wait, who's in charge of France now? Said Napoleon, trying to take over Europe. Luckily, they banished him to an island.
But he came back!
Luckily, they banished him to another island. There goes Latin America, becoming independent in the Latin American Wars of Independence. Britain just figured out how to turn steam into power, so now they can make
many different types of machines and factories with machines in them, so they can make a lot of products real fast.
Then they invent some trains and conquer India.
That's the Industrial Revolution, right? Is like a jingle, like a Nabisco jingle. That's the summary of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, and maybe put some trains there. Hey, China, said Britain. Buy stuff from us. Nah, dude, we already got everything, says China. So Britain tried to get them addicted to opium, which worked, actually. But then China made it illegal and dumped it all into the sea. So Britain threw a hissy fit and made them open up 5 cities and give them an island. Britain and Russia are playing a game where they try to stop each other from conquering Afghanistan. Also, the
Sultan of Oman lives in Zanzibar now.
That's just where he lives. India just had a revolution, and they would like to govern themselves now. Nope, said Britain, governing them even harder than before.
Technology is about to go crazy.
The United States finally figured out whether slavery is good or bad. It's bad, they decided. And then they continued manifesting their destiny, which is to kill the rest of the natives and take their land and maybe kick out the Mexicans too. I know, let's rape Africa, said Europe, scrambling to see who could rape it the fastest.
They never got Ethiopia.
Britain and France are still hungry.
They never got Thailand.
The United States ran out of destiny to manifest, so they're looking for more.
Hawaii, Cuba.
Wait, Spain controls Cuba. Well, blame something on them and go to war. What should we blame on Spain? Let's blame the main on Spain. So they blame the main on Spain. Now we're in business. To celebrate, they kick Panama out of Panama and make a canal, connecting the two oceans. Britain just found oil in the Middle East.
It makes cars go.
China is so tired of being bossed around that they delete their old government and make a new, stronger government, which is accidentally weaker and controlled by a guy from the previous government. Europe hasn't had a war since the last war, so they start World War I. Look at those guns. It's gonna be a great war. So great we won't need a second one. After it's over, they blame Germany. Russia went on strike and the workers overthrew the government. Now everyone's paycheck is the same.
Communism in the Soviet Union.
The Arabs revolt and Britain helps. Now the Ottoman Empire's gone, so we can give the
Jewish people a place to live.
Hopefully the Arabs won't mind. Let's cut the cake, said Sykes and Picot, carving up the remains of the not-so-Ottoman-anymore empire.
Except Turkey, Turkey makes a brand new turkey.
And then the Saudis conquer Arabia. It just seemed like the right thing to do. Hello? Yes, it's the 1920s calling. Let's get in the car and drive to a party and listen to jazz on the radio and go to the movies. The economy's great and it'll probably be great forever. Just kidding. Germany's back, featuring Hitler, the angry mustache model. And he's mad at the Jews for existing. Japan is finally conquering the East, and they're so excited they rape Nanking way too hard. They should probably just deny it. Hitler's out of control, so the international community tackles him and tries to explain why killing all the Jews is a bad idea, but he kills himself before they could explain it to him.
That's World War II.
Bonus round, Pacific Showdown. United States versus Japan. Fight. Finish him. Let's unite all the nations and have some...
Extinction Ball. That's Hiroshima Nagasaki bombs is Extinction Ball, as though this is Street Fighter 2. It's just like, the man is a genius. It's just perfect.
Then have some world peace. Seems legit. Hi, I'm Gandhi, and if Britain doesn't get the hell out of India, I'm going to starve myself in public. Wow, that worked. Bonus, now there's Pakistan. Actually, two Pakistans. One of them could be Bangladesh later. The Jews and the Arabs finally figured out which one of them should live in the Holy Land. Me, they both said at the same time. Let's divide up the land so everyone's happy.
Psych, they both get angrier.
Look out, China. There's a new China in China.
Okay, well, we don't need to... That's fine. That's not quite what happened, but that's fine.
China. What's on the menu? Communism. No thanks, said the other China, escaping to an island. I wonder which one is the real China. There's the Korean War, Korea versus Korea. Nobody wins, then it's on pause forever. Let's meet the sponsors. Oh, it's the two global superpowers. They're having a friendly debate over which economic system is good and which one is an evil virus of Satan. And they both have atom bombs. Fight! Wait, no, that would be the end of the world. Let's just keep it cool and spy on each other instead. And make sure we have enough atom bombs. I'll race you to space. Now let's make some more countries fight themselves. Europe is tired of pillaging other continents, and the continents they were pillaging are tired of being pillaged. So here's a new map with new countries. Now you can't tell who they're being pillaged by. The United States finally decided whether racism is good or bad. They decided it's bad, and the world agrees. South Africa might need another minute to think about it. Let's check the world population. Whoa. Okay. Technology's better too, that might keep happening. The Soviet Union decides to relax a little and accidentally falls apart. Europe makes a union, so now they can all use the same money. Except Britain, because they don't feel like it. Let's check the mail. Surprise, it's on the computer. Whoops, someone just attacked America. I bet they'll remember that. Phone call. Surprise, it's in your pocket. Wanna learn everything? Surprise, it's on the computer. Now your phone's a computer, which is in your pocket. Whoops, the economy just crashed. Don't worry, the big banks won't fail, because they're not supposed to. Surprise, flying robots. With bombs. Wanna print a brain? Some people have no friends. Some people have no food. The globe is warming.
And the ocean is full of plastic.
Let's save the planet, said everybody, not knowing how. Let's invent a thing inventor, said the thing inventor inventor after being invented by a thing inventor. That's pretty cool. By the way, where the hell are we?
And that's it, right? We got the 2008 crash, and then what was it? Drones, and then the ocean's full of plastic, and nobody can figure out climate change, and then the thing inventor. That's the end, and where the hell are we? It's fucking beautiful. It's so good. It's better than I remember. I think what's really interesting about this video is that number one, you can learn a lot, but when you don't know what's going on, it can be confusing. And so I haven't watched that in probably 5 years at least. And since that time, I've definitely learned a little bit more. I mean, I already knew kind of the cosmology and planetary science that I know now. I know a little bit more about evolutionary biology and molecular biology. I know quite a bit more about paleontology, archaeology, or biological anthropology, archaeology, and early world history. So a good amount of that got funnier because I understood what he was referencing. Once he hit kind of the Middle Ages and just past the Middle Ages, I started to not understand the references. So like, there's just so many obscure references in there that once you get lost, it's still entertaining, but I think it's more entertaining when you know every single reference. And it's just kind of coming at you at breakneck speed. So much there. I mean, I don't know how long it took him to make that, but it must have been an unbelievable amount of time because it's just so, it's not so many people could have that idea to do like, hey, let's do it all really quick, but then not have the discipline to really go through and do the research and like get all the right factoids and communicate them properly for the most part. And, just have it all make sense, right? It's very accurate and it's very succinct and poetic in the way that it's expressed, and it kind of makes you want to learn more, right? All of these little tidbits, you're like, well, what the hell was that even? What even was that? Now I got to look up Tonga time or whatever the fuck that was, or, you know, Madagascar, when the two things, who colonized Madagascar at the same time? I don't know. I don't remember that. I've never learned about that. So man, that's like a Hall of Fame video right there. That's a Hall of Fame video for both comedy and science communication / history communication. If you had not seen it until this, obviously go watch it without me interrupting. If you had seen it, hopefully you enjoyed some of the additional context that I could provide, because really every single second of that video can be turned into a 20-minute video talking about early cosmology or astrophysics and solar system formation or abiogenesis endosymbiosis or paleontology, tetrapod evolution. It's just every single little chunk. And, you know, fortunately, I do have tutorials on most of those topics. So if anything piqued your interest, look around my channel. I almost certainly have it. but it's he's a unique comedic mind. I have no idea what he's been doing. I should probably look. I don't even know if he's still making content, but he got 183 million views on that. He deserves every single one of those views. Phenomenal video. So that was fun. I hadn't seen that once again in a while, and I had a lot of fun watching that. I hope you had fun watching that with me. And so, yeah, thanks for joining me for this one. As always, I'll see you next time.